Accession number 10167, reel 14.
Mr. Ronald Elliott, reel 14. You were telling me about the problems that some of the young conscripts had when they arrived out to join the 1st Battalion. Educational problems?
Yes. I guess the Army was finding great difficulty in utilising them because of their educational deficiencies. And they had these basic educational problems, I guess, about being able to read or write in lots of cases. But instead of pitching it at a low level, it was pitched at a somewhat higher level. So, you know, we were always in some difficulty about the nature of the courses that we were given. But they were all given to us, and we had no, or very little, individual opportunity to vary the course material. We were given the course material and the nature of the subjects that we had to teach, and we just did it. And it came down to history, mathematics, English, and sort of general educational subjects, or general political subjects, I guess. And I finished up with history, I think, in the nature of it. You know, I mean, it was utterly hopeless trying to do history to these sort of people. I mean, where do you start?
How did they respond? Were they not interested because it was at the wrong level, or were they frustrated?
They didn't mind in the sense that for them it was a bit of a skive, you see. They could have been doing much worse than coming to see us, and although they weren't too attentive, and it was in our business to try and interest them if we could, at least we knew that they were willing to come because it meant that they could spend a morning down with us, away from the barracks, and they could have a smoke when they wanted to, and they didn't have to do drills or any sort of weapon training or anything quite stupid like that. It was a reasonably pleasant thing. And I think we all tried, within the nature of the syllabus that we were given, to try and make the lectures at least interesting. And what we did start with, for instance, every morning, we used to go up to the mess and listen to the news and come back and give them a précis of what the news was and comment on that. And the thing was that although we had this long syllabus of subject material that we were supposed to do, I don't think anybody in practice ever got beyond about the first or second stage in that, because it took such a long time, and most of us in the end didn't stay that long anyway. I had got history because I had done in our course, we had at the finish to do our own individual lecture based on material that we researched ourselves. That sort of APCA material there, and that what I did for the course presentation was more or less a survey of the economic situation before the war and of how the various major nations of the world got themselves into economic difficulties and how that sort of led to the war. Now, I think, honestly, that was quite interesting. Although I finished up with that as a sort of a history-type course, I gave that lecture almost ad infinitum. I was in great difficulty when I came to do the next one because that one I knew pat, and I made it quite interesting, I must say, even myself. But the next one was very difficult because then I had to go into history, you see. That was sort of an economic and political thought. But the first one, then I had to go back and sort of then to start somewhere. And that one always fell with a deep thud. So I really didn't feel that I would get terribly far with that.
Now, you'd only had a grammar school education. Were you able to manage the level at which
with those? Oh, yeah, there wasn't any problem. I mean, the nature of the response, of course, was limited. They may or may not understand it and were interested in what you had to say, but most of them weren't very critical. They couldn't criticize. My education, whatever it may be, was immeasurably superior to whatever they had. And I had done economics, and I had to take it as
were
a degree course.
Were you very informal? You were, of course, a sergeant. How informal were you with your classes?
Oh, just used to sit on the edge of the table in the front and just chat to them. With all lecturers that I used to do at any time, you've got to get close up to people and look them in the eye as much as you can, or you lose them. So, you know, you get too far away from your people, or get too involved in the mechanics of what you're up to, and you start losing the members of your class. And 35-minute talks, you know, to hold people for that length of time isn't very easy. So you really can't be too formal, I don't think, in that situation. And they weren't bright. That was the other thing. So every so now and again, you had to electrify them with things. And I had a big book on history that I took up from the reference library. And at one point in time, you used to pick it up and thump it on the table and wake everybody up and say, that is history, that is what we're supposed to be doing. But don't worry, I'm not going to go into history into that degree. And then we'd go into something somewhat more basic, I think.
Did you know that you'd been in the army, you'd been receiving drafts of conscripts throughout the war, and you'd not mentioned before that they'd come out illiterate and innumerate, but now, after the war, it seems to have been that it was much more noticeable. Is that the case? I mean, was this a particularly bad draft? Or what had happened to all the bright ones that were being conscripted?
I suppose we were getting people who had been educated during the war, for one thing, and, obviously a shortage of good teachers and what have you, and they'd lost education through air raids, I guess. And
but I was just thinking that in 44 and 45 you'd have been getting people educated in
well,
the war.
You see, where they really found the difficulty was they were wanting them to do rather more responsible jobs. They were wanting them to be NCOs in some cases, you see. They wanted to promote them. And they found that the material wasn't all that good. The weapons they were using were becoming more technical and becoming more important to use. During the war, you followed somebody and you fired a fairly limited sort of educational requirement. After the war, they're beginning to see you're going to need a reasonably standard of brightness, shall we say, level of intelligence anyway, even to be in the army. And they were falling short of that, and that was the difficulty. They couldn't see their way, either to their being able to use the new weapons very cleverly, or to be able to promote them as NCOs, junior NCOs, that is. I think they had a difficulty with the senior NCOs as well, but that's another matter. All in all, from our point of view, it was a very pleasant sort of life. We were on our own, totally unsupervised by the army. Our only responsibility was to process people that came down to us. And occasionally we fell short of that even. There was at least one morning, I remember, when we were all woken up by the sound of halt outside, and the first intake had arrived for their lessons, and everyone was in bed. To dash up, first of all, unshaven, and give them a first chat while the rest of them shaved, and we worked our way around like that. But what we did was, in the evenings we were in town, it was a small town, very nice place. It had the, rather looked like a Wild West town, it had a very wide main street, houses on each side, and we got on very well with the local population, and tavernas in town that we went to and got drunk very night. We were caught out one time. Someone did come down from the barracks to do an inspection and opened a door, and couldn't get the door open because of all the bottles that were stacked behind it. So all I think at that time we felt we were beating the system, that at last we'd got somewhere where we were enjoying army life and had got it somewhere close to the sort of civilian life that we thought we were entitled to. Well, all of us reckoned that. We had a pretty difficult war and we were just about due for some change in fortune. Except, of course, like everything else, you overdo it. We had one or two argumentative people. Jim Mulca was one who was inclined to be very argumentative about the problems and about the nature of army life. And it tended to centre upon the sergeant's mess, unfortunately. And we used to have these sergeant's mess meetings, and he in particular used to get up and complain bitterly about the nature of the sergeant's mess and how far it fell short of what he thought it ought to be, and particularly about the quality of the food and the service. So they got us onto the sergeant mess committee. That was the beginning of it. We began to see that the best thing for this lot is to put them somewhere where they have to do something to change events rather than have them sitting outside criticising all the time. And then the next thing that was manoeuvred was that I was offered the job of sergeant mess caterer. Again, it was on the same basis. I wasn't very far off being demobbed by this time anyway. I wasn't looking forward to being sergeant mess caterer at all, but I really didn't. I wasn't given much option, truthfully. And I did say, well, all right, I will do it, but I do it on my terms, or not at all. Oh, it started with they'd got themselves into a bit of a mess, I think, yes, if I remember rightly. The last sergeant mess caterer had not only made a lot of money, he'd buggered the books up. And it started off with me getting the books straight for them, because they knew I could keep books and do accounting. So I got all the books sorted out and sorted his cash out, and we'd got back to a more or less reasonable level where you could then begin to start afresh with a new account. And then they offered the job to me, or more or less said, you've got to take it, sort of thing. The only thing was that, as I said, I did have the opportunity to say, if I do take it, I take it on my terms. But I do it my way, and you will give me backing. So they said yes, not knowing, really, what was likely to happen. Well, I knew from the start that there was a hell of a lot of fiddling going on. So I just went in, and the fiddling stopped straight away. But it was very, very difficult, because one of the things I found went into this sergeant's mess room where the caterer lived, and underneath his bed was a whole trunk full of cigarettes. And one of the things that they had done was to inflate the numbers of people in the mess 200% for the cigarette entitlement. They'd got it, in fact, from two sources. So they had twice as much cigarettes. And these cigarettes were flogged in the mess, and the money went to the caterer. Also, any profits that they made out of bottles of whiskey and things, selling them by glass, went to the caterer. And there was any amount of things going on. And as soon as I went in, I said, you know, to everybody, all the stuff, it all ends from now. Nothing at all is going on. Play it by the book. And I was worried about the amount of money that was coming in. Once all the fiddles ended, the money was really fantastic. The level of profit that people ought to have made. And I said, the RSM, who was the real boss, I said to him from the beginning, look, I am not taking twice the amount of cigarettes that I want for a start. And we were getting booze on the same basis. I said, that's all going to stop. And he said, oh, no, no, I can't do that. You know, I said, we're going to make us look as though we've been on the fiddle all these years. I said, no. I said, I can't get rid of the damn stuff. I said, if I'm not selling it for myself, you know, there's nothing I can do about it. So he agreed to that very reluctantly. And I said, look, you know, if you either do agree or you don't, or I'll go and see the the commanding officer, because I said, there it is. You either want the place run properly or you don't.
Do you remember the RSM's name?
No. He was one of the old type, I mean, fellow that I didn't get on with. And they were hard drinking, and this is another aspect of it. And as far as the actual catering was concerned, any surplus monies that I had, I then channeled into getting more food. So we went out and were buying eggs and chickens and all sorts, and the quality of the food improved remarkably. But it was on the strength, really, of all the money that had been taken out of the system. And then that, and they eventually began to see that there were advantages in, you know, in running it. That what had happened was that by this silly idea, they'd just been taking money out of the mess, and they themselves were gaining. And we reduced the price of tots of drinks and so forth by charging the proper price for bottles of beer by glass, bottles of whiskey by glass and so forth. So they could see the advantages of it. But the other side of it, where I eventually got really chopped, was I didn't like this idea of them getting pissed up every night and going around causing difficulties for the staff, because I try to support the staff. And they were having to clean up after these stupid, ignorant oafs. And I remember there was one weekend, I think it was Saturday night, probably Saturday night, I think, where they'd had a long booze and they'd got drunk, and they smashed up the furniture. And I said to the RSM next morning, I'm not having my people clean it up. And there was quite a battle went on. And I didn't win that one. Eventually, my people had to go in and clean it up.
Your people were, who were they?
The sergeant mess staff. They were cleaning staff and catering staff, and they were just ordinary soldiers. But you know, they belonged to me, and I was trying to look after them, because they used to get kicked around a bit. They used to throw their weight around at some of the sergeants. But I didn't win that battle in the end. I lost that one completely. And there was no way I could change the nature of the life that they wanted to adopt. So I was not very far away from leaving that time, so I just let that one go. But I did say, look, you know, whatever you do in future, do not give it to people who are due to be retired. So that's where you really start to have problems. Everything, the books were up to date and the cash was bang on and the system worked when I handed it over, so I was quite happy that it was on a straightforward basis. But as far as the moral side of it was concerned, it didn't change that one bit. What happened after that? I left, so it was the end of it. So I left Greece and came to England.
That would be in November 46?
November 46.
And this was your D-mob?
Yes, that was my D-mob. I was discharged in June, actually.
In 47?
That was finally, but you had leave and all that. So I was in Farnborough in southern England for a few weeks, I think.
What were you doing there, roughly speaking?
It was more or less just as you might be in a transit camp. You used to do guard duties and NCO's duties and that sort of thing. I think I was still a sergeant.
It was just a general depot, was it?
Yes. You used to have what they call these transit depots, where people were just waiting for things to happen, usually for more training or medical reasons or waiting to be moved on somewhere else. So it tended to be just an administrative thing, and you used to use the staff to do jobs for you. I mean, I had it at the beginning. If you're an orderly, you'd have to go and get a hold of people to do cleaning work or move objects from here to there or provide support for or whatever.
Isn't this a rather boring, negative period?
Oh, yes. But, I mean, I was coming towards the end. I'd left everybody behind then. I had nobody with whom I was close. The ones that I was latterly with, I'd left behind in Greece.
Were you not... I mean, it's a long time to wait in a sort of vacuum. Were you not frustrated?
Well, we used to go up to London from there. Used to go up to London for long weekends. And this is what I remember... Yeah, I don't know whether you know that, but that is the period, 1947, about the worst winter I think there has been in England. And That may have been perhaps the reason why there was all the hold-up. We were in Farnborough, near Camberley, in proper barracks. And they had very little coal. We had these big stoves, as they all have, in barrack rooms, and very little coal. And we used to go into the huts that weren't used, or the huts that you use for drying clothes, and take up the floorboards and burn them. So anybody went into these places, they fell right through the floor. We had a tax that we used to mount on the coal dump. That was barbed wired off, but used to have to get over the wall and fill bags full of coal and come back, all sorts of things. It was diabolical, there wasn't any heating at all. So, you know, they used to send you home for long weekends, or send you up to London for long weekends, and we used to stay in the Union Jack Club because it was warmer in there. So, for that reason, but it was a pretty poor period of time from a weather point of view anyway.
Now, the Labour government had been in for 2 years. Was there still support for it in the army?
Oh, yes. I think for all of that. I mean, they were doing things, weren't they? Making changes as when all the benefit legislation came in of health service and national insurance and all of the basic changes that the Labour government introduced were all in the process of being pursued. But one aspect, I think, which worried people was that, of course, there was still the austerity there. You know, economic problems. In the end, the Germans did rather better than we did because they got help. We didn't get any help. So there was rationing still continuing. And the quality of life wasn't terribly high. But the people were generally behind the government. They appreciated the economic problems were something that couldn't be helped because we had, in fact, actually completely gutted ourselves, sold off all our assets, and if it hadn't been for some help, lend-lease from America, I guess, would have been even more difficulty. But we'd pretty well hocked everything in the state of the war and the need for fighting the war.
Were there any actual party members within the army, or was that not allowed?
In the sense that there were
Labour Party members, or
I think we're all Labour Party members. I mean, nobody was affiliated or whatever like that. I mean, people, some were more strong than others.
But you weren't formally members of any party?
No, no. I mean,
how did you come
just
to
just barrack room lawyers and this sort of thing?
How did you come to actually leave then? What was the final process?
You'd go to this demob centre, as I remember. You'd have a medical. And part of the cleverness of that was that they would certify that you were fit, and you would sign that you were fit, and therefore you had no claim against the army for anything subsequently that might occur, that you might feel that you ought to get a pension for or some such. So they made sure that you had no liabilities against them. And then you handed over all of your kits that you had, and anything that wasn't there you paid for. And you were given civilian clothing, which more or less fit. I mean, the quality of the stuff was, had a suit, I think, and underclothes and shirts and hats, tie, I think, overcoat, raincoat, I think, not quite sure now, and shoes and things, and came out looking horrible. But at least one was free. Finished, it was all over and done with.
So you had leave from about April, and you left in...
I was finally discharged in June, but I guess I left in April. But it was forwarded to June by the time I'd completed all my demarc.
You'd done a variety of things which could have led to a variety of careers, in a sense, because you'd been a signaller, which could have led to a career. You'd been in this education thing, which could have led you into teaching. And, of course, you'd got your bookkeeping and such like.
Yeah.
Did you see yourself as having a range of opportunity, or were you still worried and hoping to get your job back at South Shields?
I saw myself as having possibilities, yeah. I was very much taken with education, and there were large opportunities, great opportunities at that time for teaching profession. What happened was, though, that because of the nature of the sort of army career I had, as I say, I was just wanting a peaceful life, so I took the easy way out and just went straight back to where I was. And they did find me a job, and I wasn't too unhappy with it. It was fairly senior. So, and something that I became interested in, as it happened. But not very long afterwards, and I know there were a number of us who were keen at the time and almost decided to take it up. They came along with schemes whereby you could transfer to teacher training and get support and grants and things, because they were terribly short of teachers. And I was very, very tempted at that point in time to be a teacher. But what had happened was, I'd become interested in economics. And although I ought to have been taken in an accounting qualification for the nature of the job that I was supposed to be doing, I did an economics degree, first of all, in my spare time at home. And with the nature of having two, I was felt that two were better than one, as there's always gone to an accounting qualification subsequently. But what happened was that somehow foolishly, at that point in time, to do a degree, you had to take languages as well to pass at both levels, both preliminary and finals. And I had to take two languages, and I passed in the French all right. The other language I took was German, and I'd been learning German for years. But I failed German on about three or four occasions, and I had to do the whole damn thing again over many years. So by the time I did get my economics degree, finally, I was so cheesed off with working, you know, in the spare time, because I took all your spare time up and you didn't have much of a life after that. I was buggered if I would do any more, so I didn't do an accounting. So there I was in an essential accounting career with only an economics degree. And that was after the teacher opportunity had passed. So I could have still gone into teaching, I guess. But not long after that, I saw an advert to join, or an advert, advertising a job with Roundtree's, the chocolate people, for someone with an economics degree to go into one of their departments, and I applied and I got that job. So I moved out into private industry then. Into York it was. Went down to York. And I'd met my wife and sort of got married down there. But the interesting thing was that I stayed in this job, which was in the sort of the personnel department then, and had to do with research into labour statistics and so forth, and that's why they wanted an economics degree. And some few years later, I was in charge of the department, but my boss had gone on to become labour manager, and he and I didn't see eye to eye. And I did an investigation into some accounting problems they had up in the factory. They'd built a factory up at Ford and had Roundtree's at that time. And they offered me a job up there. So I took a job up there. And I finished up... Sorry? And I finished up as chief accountant. But there again, I had no accounting qualifications. But what it was an administrative job in a financial department. So it all sort of comes around the circle again.
Did you have any...
And I did a lot of lecturing, yeah. You know, so
did you have any particular loyalty to the DLI, or was that just part of your life you'd rather forget?
No, I have, because, you know, we've kept the association going, and I've been to